Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, May 13th. I'm your host, Magnus Teevil. Joining me in the studio today is
Peter R.H.
And we've got a good show for you today. In a moment, we're going to bring you a segment on the 25th anniversary of VANDU, which is the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, which is advocated for the users in the downtown east side and beyond for 25 years. We'll get to that piece in a little bit. Peter's here to talk. What are you going to talk about today, Peter?
About the LaRouche organization. Finally, I'm going to talk about it. I've been sidetracked.
Lyndon LaRouche. Okay. We also have our gardening segments and good music, and also a piece around Indigenous redress. So all that's coming up and more here on CJSF. And Speak Up. So we're going to start with our segment about VANDU, and we'll bring you that now, and then we'll be back with Peter.
Gallery Gastation is an archival retrospective of VANDU, Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. The curatorial committee and Alu Moroti George, director-curator, were tasked with a new approach to curation, not one of art, but one of the history of a political organization whose function is as ongoing as the issues they cover in the downtown east side. The exhibition was divided into four sections: loss, origins, power, and intimacy. The images on the walls were of those who had been lost to overdose. Origins pulled together archival documents to challenge, quote, the state's status quo and rules of engagement, end of quote. In power, the exhibition included documentation of civil action and collective liberation, and lastly, intimacy, where VANDU's archives brought forth images that, amongst other things, are, quote, symbols of the moments of joy that exist amidst a prolonged war against the state, a sign of life, end of quote. Alu Moroti George, director-curator at Gallery Gachet, joined CFRO to discuss the current exhibition highlighting the work of VANDU and celebrating their 25th anniversary. Alu Moroti, can you tell us about the VANDU exhibition?
So the exhibition is called To Be Belligerent, To Commit to Memory, To Live Without Fear. Okay. It is an archive exhibition that surveys 25 years of VANDU's history that was co-curated by me and members of the VANDU team. In this particular exhibition, I am kind of thinking of it, as well as the members of VANDU, to like use the space as consecrated grounds for reflection and like to build a general understanding of VANDU's contributions to our social and cultural landscape in Vancouver, which I think is extremely necessary now considering the stakes of everything that's going on in Vancouver with our new, I wouldn't even say there are new governments anymore, but kind of seeing the policies that our government has implemented and how it's affecting the members of the downtown east side. And I'm thinking about the years of activism and general community building that VANDU has contributed to in the downtown east side landscape.
And when you talk about the difficulties that are coming up, are you talking about the decampments or the making the use of drugs in public spaces illegal?
The state-sanctioned violence that is happening in the downtown east side, the lack of humanity that is being shown to drug users, not just in the downtown east side, but like in the greater Vancouver area and in Richmond, and this general understanding that people have of drug users in Vancouver and how they pose them as just an anomaly to our society, a nuisance, without really understanding the reality of drug use and like without care. And we are seeing the effects of that primarily in the downtown east side with the like the choreography of violence that is coming in every way and just affecting residents of the downtown east side. The exhibition in itself is meant to create discourse. I think that the exhibition is more than about drug use. I think the exhibition is about people's surviving, people reasserting their humanity, and kind of thinking about just the general landscape of Vancouver culturally, socially, and politically, and how it has changed in the years, in the 25 years of Vandu's inception. We can identify these changes and see where we have gone wrong and see where we can do better, both as a society, but also like as individuals. I'm hoping that for Vandu members and for drug users, this exhibition kind of acts as a reassertion of their humanity. It acts as a reminder that people have fought for them and that there is so much more to this world. And I'm hoping that for people who are not familiar with the downtown east side, people who are not drug users, they come into the exhibition and see other ways of being. The exhibition was carefully curated to kind of begin with loss and to even attempt to visualize how many members of Vandu and Vandu's network, solely Vandu's network, and also general members of residents of the downtown east side, have lost their lives to the toxic drug crisis. And it's really like bizarre and jarring seeing these images and like just seeing the number of people, the people that Vandu knew, and there are more people in the downtown east side that we didn't know and like are not in Vandu's network who have lost their lives. So yeah, it really becomes a matter of like survival and like livingness and how to keep people alive. And I think that's what people are misunderstanding with when we're seeing like just a general decline for the safe ejection sites in places like Richmond and like Vancouver, like downtown Vancouver, like Yaletown. The issue is not that the government is trying to make people do more drugs or like people are trying to make people do more drugs. I think the thing is that people are trying to keep drug users like any other human being alive, and that's very important.
That was Alumaroti George at Gallery Gache. Talila Gregg is the president of Western Aboriginal Harm Reduction Society. She sits on a coalition for Our Homes Can't Wait, and is not only the vice president of Vandu, she actively works on the front desk as an overdose attendant. She joined CFRO to discuss Vandu's 25th anniversary and their exhibition at Gallery Gache.
Tell us what the most important thing Vandu does right now, 25 years later. What would that look like?
Saving lives and educating people.
So how do you save lives?
If somebody goes down, right? Or just giving people information, that's saving a life, right? Mm-hmm. Type of harm reduction, teaching them.
And the information that you give, is that like just talking to people when they come in or?
Yeah, or trying to point them to the right place. And giving them information that would be helpful for them to continue on with their day or to do more with what they've been doing.
And when you say saving lives, is that saving lives in the building or?
Yeah, well, we even do, sometimes somebody will say, oh, somebody's ODing out there, and then we'll go running out with an air tank and Narcan kit and oximeter and all that, and hopefully we can do the right thing.
What's in the future for Vandu?
To keep going, you know, regardless with what's going on in the world and, you know, how they're making it so people can't use outside or just anything like that, right?
What's the difference between Vandu as a harm reduction organization and, say, another one that maybe be set up by the street nurses?
Well, I believe we're both the only one that's peer-run and peer-led. We're part of the people, you know? We get along with the people because we understand.
The Premier, David Eby, just announced that he has recriminalized the use of drugs in public. How will that impact on the downtown east side and your work?
Badly, because a lot of people use outside because a lot of them can't have people come over in their SROs or the bugs or else it's too hot or something, so they go outside to use. Mm-hmm. Now they're going to be after forced to go inside, and a lot of them will have to be by themselves.
You have an exhibition happening at Galerie Gachet. If you were to encourage people to go there, what would you say they would get out of it?
Like people's stigmatized, right? And they judge and all that. And if they were to check out and understand more, then it would probably change your outlook on it.
We've been talking with Delilah Gregg, Vice President of Vandu, and Alumaroti George, Director Curator at Galerie Gachet. Gachet is located in the heart of the downtown Eastside, and information about how you can see Vandu's exhibition can be found on their website. This is Bernadine Fox reporting for The Pulse at Vancouver Co-op Radio and frequencynews.ca with funding by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program of the Department of Canadian Heritage, and distributed by the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
And Vandu has been a presence in the downtown east side, representing and advocating on behalf of drug users for 25 years. It's an important perspective because, of course, as they mentioned in the story, Vandu is made up from the community of drug users themselves. They're not professional. They're not healthcare professionals. They're not, you know, activists coming from elsewhere to help out there, the people on the street there. And it's important to have that voice in the larger conversation. One thing, you know, David Eby and the provincial government have got permission from the federal government to alter the pilot project on drug decriminalization to have some of those measures rolled back to I suppose, recriminalize certain public drug use. And we'll see what effect that have, although as someone who's been walking through the downtown east side daily for many, many years, I don't know if I noticed a lot of difference between before decriminalization and after decriminalization in terms of seeing people using on the street. And I suspect that won't change much with the recriminalization. I suspect a lot of the impacts will be in further afield areas where public open drug use has never been sort of something people were seeing, and then with decriminalization perhaps became something people were seeing. And I guess it provides a tool for the police and others to deal with those situations. I certainly have sympathy on both sides of this issue. Obviously, you know, decriminalization is probably one of the steps in addressing the drug crisis we see in BC. But I can also see that people will not be comfortable with things like open drug use in parks or close or even in school properties and other places that people go.
Okay. maybe I'll do put 5 cents here.
Yeah.
Is that the people that, medical doctors and so on, who are sort of, who are putting forth this that we have to whatever. It comes from a variety of approaches, what they're saying, how to deal with it. These people themselves tend not to be drug users, as it were. I actually, at the Vancouver Institute once, I talked to one person, and he said, no, I haven't taken it. The thing is that I find, it was on the Georgia Strait maybe a year ago, they had an article, and it was one of the advocates or maybe an ex-drug user, and had an article about it, and then when they said, oh, well, we don't want what is medically prescribed, we want to have what the user wants. Well, I mean, you see, the people that are saying, okay, we are the medical community, we think it should be decriminalization and so on, so we are prescribing what it is. If you kind of go even further, what the person wants, I mean, it's, you know, it's, you're going away from what the medical community sort of said, what's the best approach. So that's all what I have to say about it. It's a matter of how far do you go, and it's like nothing seems to make some people happy as such. Okay, that's...
And I think that recognizes that it really is a complex issue, this whole issue of how to deal with the drug crisis that we're faced with. You know, about a year ago or so, before this trial started, the decriminalization trial, and it's part of a three-year pilot program, and I guess they'll see how it goes, and depending on that, you know, permanent changes may be put in place. You know, there were definitely people, before it started, you know, people advocating that, you know, the measures that were being introduced didn't go far enough, that more needed to be done, that the idea of prescribing, making, you know, the drugs available through a sort of prescription kind of setup, and all those were inadequate and not enough. And other people were, of course, predicting that the sky was going to fall as soon as this happened. And, of course, what we see is that, you know, with what's happened so far is, I'm sure there's been benefits. We're not really seeing the full picture of what's happening with the trial. But, you know, one of the downsides is that, you know, if open drug use is legal, then people can and will do it wherever they want to and feel they need to. What I was saying when it was my comment a moment ago is that, you know, people have always used at least drugs openly in the downtown east side, all along Main Street and in the alleys and in the surrounding streets and stuff. That was happening before decriminalization. That was happening after decriminalization. And we'll probably continue after they make the changes they're making right now. One of the things, though, that does happen is if someone is, you know, openly using drugs in a location that is perhaps inappropriate, and whether it's a park or a schoolyard or, you know, just a residential street, you know, the police or whoever else, you know, can't come and say, well, you're not allowed to do that here, because they are allowed to do that here, even though it is creating a problem. In some ways, it's a bit analogous to, you know, alcohol in parks and beaches. People have always taken a beer or a bottle of wine to the beach or the park. And for the most part, if they were discreet about it and behaving themselves, they would be left alone. But if you're being rambunctious and creating a problem, the police would come along and make you show what you had and pour it all out and be able to deal with the problem. But if you're allowed to drink in the park, being rambunctious and disturbing other people isn't enough to deal with the problem. And I think it's a bit of the same thing with the decriminalization, is that sometimes I think these tools allow a way for, you know, authorities to deal with problem behavior related to the use of those substances, whether it's drugs or alcohol, while sort of quietly closing their eyes to people who are perhaps doing that but not making a problem of it.
I'd like to add, one of the problems that came up was when they said, oh, you can legally have such an amount.
Mm-hmm.
What they were saying was, well, they go to their dealer and they don't sell on that small amount. We're going to be stuck with a larger amount,
yeah,
for example. But, I mean, I think, not to say what kind of side I'm taking, there is sort of a peripoly of side, I guess, that's like saying we've had enough of this and we keep going with this, and it's just not working out. Oh, I mean, I'm just putting all the dimensionality. It's mm-hmm. sort of a balancing thing. So my father once said to me, a bleeding heart liberal, someone who's very concerned whether the prisoners in jail have their mistakes cooked properly. So I guess that's the Pierre-Poly of approach there.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm glad you brought up Pierre Polyev, because one thing I think is really unfortunate about this whole issue is when people just overly politicize the approach, because it really is a complex problem. And we know for a fact that, you know, criminalization or the war on drugs approach of arresting people and putting them in jail and the rest of that stuff doesn't work. We've been doing that for 40 or 50 years, and the problem has not gone away. But a lot of people have ended up in jail and with criminal records and whatnot. So,
well, it's also complex on both sides.
Exactly.
Like as I say, like that Georgia Strait article was saying, well, we don't want what is medically prescribed them. We want what they want. Well, if they go with that, arguably, they're going to be dead, or they're going to have so much they want to die, or they're going to be very sick, and we have to deal with it. And it's sort of, some people just say, well, get an island, get as much as you want, and you'll die on this island away from all the rest of us.
And, you know, all respect to drug users, and they come in all shapes and sizes, so I hesitate to
not to say
make an overly generalization, but
I was expressing the view as totally agreeing with it.
Yeah, I'm agreeing with you. They're not always making the smartest choices to just say, oh, we'll give them what they're... And I'm sure that's not exactly what they're saying, but I don't think when politicians like Pierre Poilievre simply take a simplistic and politicized approach to it, where they're not really seriously trying to address the issue. They're just trying to address for example, or stoke people's fears or prejudices in respect to the issue.
Well, not entirely. I mean, I'm going to say not entirely. I think he's in good faith a little bit, or as such.
Okay. All right. Well, that's, I think we'll see where this issue goes. We're only about a year into this pilot project, and they're not scrapping the pilot project. They're not completely rolling back all the things they're doing. They're just amending the pilot project to deal with issues of safe supply and decriminalization and the rest of it. And it's got two more years to run. And, hopefully this, along with everything else they're doing, will perhaps teach us a better way forward. And we'll have to see what happens as that project rolls along. Let's take a quick look at the weather here. This week, looking pretty good. A bit of mix of sun and cloud for today. Highs up to 18. You can see that outside. It's quite warm, but overcast.
It was cold coming here. I should have worn a jacket. I was stuck out because of wearing a jacket.
I was wearing a hoodie, and I was too hot in the bus. But, that's because it was a pretty crowded bus, so, it gets pretty warm in there. It's going to be pretty clear through the middle of the week. Highs up to 18 or 19 degrees and clear overnight with the sun or the clouds returning a bit on Thursday night, and the rest of the Friday and the weekend will be a mix of sun and cloud. No real expectation of rain, though. And you can expect those warm temperatures, 17, 18, 19 degrees, to continue through to the end of the weekend. That's our weather for this week. We have a track here from local artist Ecstasy. This is Problems featuring Trippie Redd. Ecstasy, and a track called Problems, featuring Tracy Redd. Peter, yeah. You're going to talk to us about a very well-known...
Oh, is it well-known?
I think he's fairly well-known.
He died in...
Right-wing or conservative commentator... Lyndon LaRouche.
Well, I attended the meetings during the 1990s. And
which meetings were those?
Of the organization.
Uh-huh.
And so I guess it's sort of known about over the years. What happened was he was placed in jail.
Well, why don't we back up for a second and just sort of set up who he is.
He ran for president every year from 1976 to, I think, 2012. And he died, I think, 2019.
Yep.
And but he ran for president. He tried to get the Democratic ticket and failed. And then he would be an independent.
Right.
And Donald Trump has some hope because he did run for president while in jail.
Okay.
In 1992.
Although he wasn't successful.
No, he wasn't. He wasn't even a Ross Perot, because Ross Perot got a significant number of votes.
Yeah.
He never really got that. It was accused of being a cult, a political cult. And there was very aggressive fundraising as such. And here's an issue I'm going to bring up about it.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1989, I think just prior to the arrest of, which was kind of warranted because he had done some very illegitimate fundraising practices and the taxation. He had a big mansion. I forget where, but so he was living fine. But he said, I don't have that much money. And he was him with Helga Zarus, his wife, who's still alive. And so I kind of see it. They had him kind of dead to rights. But I'm going to bring up in 1970, somebody did a essay on the comic strip Little Abner, which was a bit. Because usually you do an essay on Jane Austen or something. For his English distortion, I said, I'm going to do it on a comic strip. And then he published it. So he came up with an idea that he said, in Little Abner, what happens is it's not good versus evil. It's evil versus evil, but they're opposite evils. So this is how I kind of see the whole thing happening, that the LaRouche organization, I was there. I saw kind of, and they didn't like me a lot of the time. But I think the reasons he got attacked was kind of what the father Bush, George H. Bush, was really behind him. See, we got to get rid of this guy. Well, what about other cults? Like the L. Ron Hubbard cult. I mean, they never really came up against them. Now then, Dennis King in 1989 wrote a book, The New American Fascism, the LaRouche Organization. Now, I'm going to read a bit from her, and I think this is important. Okay. Lyndon LaRouche seems to be learning from third world countries, which use political rhetoric and demonstrations as a tactic to delay paying the interest on the bloated loans from imperialist countries, quote unquote. The lawsuits against the organization by New York Telephone probably cost the company more.